Andrew's comment. Even if the discounting of the expected payment of the deferred tax obligation was the only thing that made it different, you'd have a day two adjustment.
Yep.
So it's unavoidable in a sense. Okay, I think we've got what we need on this one. Subject to proposed changes in wording, are there any objections to the agenda decision? Well, you guys are on a roll on taxes. You need to bring us more. Okay, last issue for today, I believe. Testing of PP&E.
Good afternoon, and it's one more easy paper to get over with and end the day much more quicker. At the meeting in March 2016, you've decided to recommend to the board to amend IA 16 to prohibit the deduction of any proceeds from sale of items produced while making an asset available for use from the cost of that asset. You've also asked us to analyze if any additional disclosure requirements and special transition requirements would be needed. Now, Agenda Paper 5 considers the disclosure requirements and the transition requirements for the proposed amendments. Based on our analysis in paragraphs 6 to 14 of the paper, we recommend that no additional disclosure requirements should be included in the proposed amendments. Existing disclosure requirements in other standards, for example, IFRS 15 and IAS 2, are sufficient. With that, we turn to question 1 in the paper at the top of page 5 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation not to include additional disclosure requirements.
Sandy, I'll let you come in first on this one.
I was looking for my paper. My paper's all out of order here, but my recollection of what it says off the top of my head was that wouldn't make any disclosures because the items that would be classified as revenue would be covered by IFRS 15. I think that's correct.
Yeah.
But wasn't the question if some amount of items were still deducted that we would disclose them? I thought that was a question, and I was just literally trying to look for the paper as y'all were talking. Because the adoption method would suggest, so let's say that items are now not netted against the proceeds, or not netted against the PP&E, but are put up in revenue, and they're disclosed as a certain type of revenue, but it's all a cumulative effect and it goes forward, it would change revenue, it would change the margin, it would all be on a prospective basis, and we wouldn't really make any additional disclosures about it. Am I misunderstanding that's what it's saying? So we sort of just march on down the road with the margin changing, possibly without really any significant articulation of it.
Katrina?
So I was just going to clarify, Sandy, that I think you've kind of moved into the second question, which is transition, and you're right that at least what we're recommending in the paper around transition is prospective, but is that right? You're sort of concerned about the information available from a prospective transition approach?
No.
Well, I guess what I'm looking at is what is the overall, when this is all said and done, what am I going to see in the financial statements, right? So the things that I'm netting, if memory serves me correctly, I'm not going to disclose. Things I'm not netting are going to be up in revenue, and they may or may not be significant enough to meet the disaggregation requirements that are in paragraph 114 here. I found it. And so I'm just thinking about what ultimately the financial statements look like. And the transition, I actually go in there, and you're right, I did conflate the two issues. Because I'm thinking about what it looks like when it changes and what that might tell me too.
Mary, do you want to come in here?
I did. Sandy, just to point out that while the, sorry, and I'm taking this just from the agenda paper itself, the committee, I think, considered restricting what was netted against the carrying value of PP&E, but ultimately concluded that it would ban netting anything against PP&E, so there would be nothing that was netted. It would all be flowing through P&L, both the cost of producing and any revenue generated from the sales of those items. So,
okay.
So there's nothing that's net. It's just a revenue income issue.
Okay, I didn't remember exactly, and I didn't bring all those old papers home. So, over the weekend. So, okay. So now, if it's prospectively adopted, then my prior period won't have the adjustment. It won't be in revenue, and my current period it will be in revenue.
I think we prospective we are saying would be from the beginning of the earliest period presented in the financial statement. So the amendment would be applied consistently across all the periods in the financial statements in which the amendments are first applied.
So it would be prospective, or it would be retrospective then?
It's like a modified retrospective. I wouldn't say fully retrospective.
You don't go back and unwind all of the embedded credits and fixed assets back before the beginning of the earliest period. But it is prospective from the beginning of the earliest period presented.
Okay.
Now, what you do lose, and what I expected you to focus on, and I bring this up only because we've got some time, is potentially you lose any information about the amount of depreciation that didn't get booked. Because this revenue will frequently be in cases in which you are not yet depreciating the asset. So the margin will look different. And I would think a question for you is, are the disclosures sufficient to let you focus in on that point?
Well, but let me make certain I understand what you're saying. You're saying that... So I'm going to go back, and all the things I would have netted, or I did net, against the PPE in years 1, 2, and 3 are now up in revenue, right? But I still have some for years back that are netted against the depreciation.
That's correct.
Right, so they're impacting my margin going forward, right? So, yes, the issue is, you're right, it's modified prospective and not retrospective in the sense of going back. Yeah, that would be nice, but I know you're a prospective adopter. So I don't know, that would obviously be nice, it'll only be entirely cleaned up until when all of the assets that are being currently had that effect have been fully depreciated. True?
Yeah.
And then you won't have the benefit. You won't have the benefit of the reduction in the depreciation that you're no longer seeing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that would be ideal, but I with some of the other conversations we've had today, I recall Alan Teixeira saying we only do retrospective when it's easy, and it's never easy, so we hardly ever do it. that would be my ideal situation, but I accept that that's not what this says.
So much cynicism in one so young. Reinhardt?
Okay, I like that part.
I agree with the staff recommendations not to have additional disclosures, but I do think it would be important in at least the basis for conclusions to highlight why that is and along the lines of what's in the paper. Because as we're talking about, the margin will be different. You won't have depreciation because typically that asset will not be available or in the condition management intended for you. So I think emphasizing in the basis for conclusions, some expectation about what one might disclose under the existing standards would be helpful.
Okay. Point taken. Martin?
Yeah, I guess the requirements we have in IFRS 1514 and then IS2, according to my mind, are sufficient if we really talk about material effects. So we have these disclosure requirements, and then also for analysts, investors, it would be visible. So therefore, I would agree to have no further additional disclosures. With regard to the wording in 20A, I understand from a principled basis that we are writing in accordance with other applicable standards. Yeah. So an entity recognizes the proceeds from selling such items and the cost of proceeding those items in profit or loss in accordance with other applicable standards. Question is whether we could be more precise. Or so, I mean, if someone is not that used to that language, I'm not sure whether we need.
We can rattle them off. Point taken. Yongsoo?
I think we need some additional disclosure just because it's not just depreciation that makes the difference in the cost, but the whole cost will disappear in the process of testing. In the process of testing, whole cost is going to go to the fixed asset, so that we recognize only revenue and no cost of the product at all. So that, you know, the margin between the process of testing and margin after we finish the testing would be so much different. So I mean, you know, you can say that materiality, or you know, the disclosure requirement in IFRS 15 can make the entity to disclose that, but I think this difference is so much, so big.
I wonder though, to the extent, to use the example of mining and oil and gas, to the extent there are lifting costs, those would go to P&L,
okay,
as would the proceeds of the testing.
It's depreciation that's missing.
I think it is depreciation that's the big one that would be absent.
Yeah, but if you think about some other industries like bio industry, you know, to make some testing products, what they have to do is to put some raw materials and the labors, and all those costs will be included into the cost of testing for the fixed asset, as the acquired cost of the fixed asset. So it's not going to be recognized as an expense for the period.
I think there would be.
Is that right?
Bob has a good suggestion? Bob, well, do you have a good suggestion on this?
Jeez, now the pressure. So I came across this issue as I was reading the agenda decision, where in paragraph 17 we talk about the cost of testing, and then in paragraph 28 we talk about the cost of producing. And it occurred to me that at best case, somebody's going to have to decide, well, I've got a cost here. And the example I used yesterday was, I got a cigarette machine. I'm testing it. I've got paper, tobacco, labor, electricity. I'm going to have to decide, well, which, at best case, which are those costs that are testing and which costs are cost of producing. At worst case, and I can live with that, making that decision, might be helpful to have something that gives priority or precedent. At worst case, I could sit here and read it and say, oh, my cost, for example, electricity, it meets both the cost of testing and the cost of producing. I've got a conflict here. So I thought, can't we fix it by amending paragraph 17 to say the cost of testing whether the asset is functioning properly, to the extent it's not a cost of producing, gets added to the asset.
Okay.
I think just to clarify so that everybody else can think about it, I think what that would do is it would effectively sort of say any cost directly of producing these items that are sold, so sort of the cost of inventory that you've sold, any of those costs would be considered to be, you know, cost directly attributable to selling, so it would go to P&L, and it wouldn't be considered cost of testing that you capitalize as part of the PP&E.
Okay. All right, let's do that. They're subject to objection, certainly. Bruce?
I was just going to comment on the disclosure. I mean, I didn't think we need any additional disclosure. I think if you read through what's there in 2 and 15, I think we've got enough. I think if it's material enough, people are going to make the disclosure. Also, my from what I've spoken to people, I mean, for those companies who are heavily affected by this, they'll make it clear what they're doing. I mean, they'll need to.
Yeah.
Well, the guys are saying, you know, the problem is when you stop messing with the revenue line, you've got to explain it. And, you know, if these aren't sustainable, if these aren't gains that are going to be ongoing, or because they happen to be testing, they'll very clearly want to make that very clear to people that this is a one-off. So from what I've understood, they'll make those disclosures.
John?
Yeah, I would not have any specific disclosure requirements, but I do think, and we sort of touched on this, I do think there is a big issue of cost attribution. And that's not just the cost of testing, because we're proposing that all the revenues go to the income statement. So there's a question about what is the cost of that inventory, not just the testing cost, but everything else that's occurring. What's capital? I mean, it's no different than the issue with IFRIC 20, which is a cost attribution interpretation between the benefit to future periods and the inventory produced in the current period. So it's exactly the same issue. It would seem, I think the one thing that would be of benefit, and I think it's probably captured by other disclosure requirements, but maybe in the basis attention can be drawn to them. I think the method, I think the approach used for cost attribution to the inventory would be of particular interest to the user, the financial statements. Because I think some people will say there is no cost, it's all capitalized, like Jung Soo has said. I think others will say, well, the cost is equal to the revenue, there's such a zero margin, and others will come up with some type of scientific approach for allocating the cost between inventory and capital. But I do think that's going to make a fundamental difference to the profitability reported in relation to this revenue.
Okay. Andrew and Bob again, or and Jim, and then we'll go. Andrew?
It's just to send a small note of caution on the question of cost attribution, because the issue goes rather more widely than just within this interpretation. And maybe if I give an example, let's say I'm a natural resources early stage explorer producer, and I'm in process of digging the shafts. Well, in the dirt that I dig out, I'm going to have some gold. So what I do is I sell the stuff that I've dug out the ground, but all the costs that I've got here is going against PP&E, because that's part of the construction of the mine. So I'll have revenue with no cost. So there just needs to be a little bit of care that we don't drift across into things that aren't quite covered by the interpretation.
Jim?
I think I agree with the staff recommendation, just to add a little bit kind of a personal view on that, because I think having this little bit tweaked profitability pattern, like Wayne just mentioned, test results will have no depreciation. But I think that reflects the true economic pattern of these items. They are test results. And of course, we should not have something with only pure revenue with practically no cost. You have labor, you have some direct expenses or costs associated with that. And by the general rule of cost allocation or attribution, I think the accounting process should reflect that part of the cost. That's it. That's the nature of these products. And without depreciation, I'm fine with that, because the machine itself or the equipment hasn't yet been completed. But I think I'm comfortable with this kind of a treatment, just without depreciation, but should with some other direct or identifiable costs. I believe that's the nature of these kind of items.
Okay. Tony, last call.
So, yeah, I'm much the same place as Reinhardt and John about just not requiring additional disclosures, but explaining why we're not requiring additional disclosures. I guess I probably echo Andrew's note of caution around being very careful what we say about costs, because I think there are some circumstances where you could argue that all of the costs are the cost of testing. And I just, Bob's suggestion says, well, you first think about whether they're cost of production and then whether they're cost of testing. I think we just need to think through that a little bit more. I haven't done that yet, but I just think there's a danger of drifting into the area of costs. And we might just want to be careful, since what we're really focusing on is what do you do with the credit. I just worry about spending too much time thinking about the costs, because there's an awful lot of detail in there, as John says, around the way that costs will get attributed.
Yeah, I think historically standard setters are lousy at cost accounting. It's just we've never been able to do a great job of it, at least not in my career.
Except you for
20. Yeah, and just to let you know, at this stage, I mean, our thoughts that we weren't really going to go there at all, but the idea when we refer to just cost of producing, that would sort of directly just refer into what already is there, say an IS2 for inventory, so we weren't intending to go into that zone, so we'll just try and be careful.
Okay, I think we've got general support here. Jung Soo?
May I ask a question, Yang? If we recognize this amount as a revenue, yeah, you are saying this is a faithful representation of economics. I agree. However, do you think this information is relevant? Is it still relevant for maybe predicting future cash flows?
I think it is relevant, because if that's, again, back to the kind of the economic nature of this activity. And during the kind of a design and manufacturing of these equipments, and we have these byproducts, and having them going through the P&L, that's temporary. These components or these test results will be done for this short period of time. And just a byproduct. It's not a completed process per se, because the rest of the machine or the process hasn't been created or tested. So that temporary result should be reflected through the P&L. And all these longer term values or asset value or capitalized value, it should be in the machine or the equipment itself.
Okay.
Yes, but I have concerns with the consistency with the US GAAP. However, huge amount of a kind of a profit on over maybe a couple of years of this biochem companies are owning some gas industries at the early stage. This kind of huge amount do not represent or do not maybe not be useful in predicting future cash flows. It's overly maybe estimated number than their real cash, actual cash flows. That's what I'm saying. So maybe some relevance might be you are losing some relevance in these huge amount of profits at the early stage of these companies.
I think that's subject to the cost accounting practice they would like to, yes, to implement while they're selling or they're considering the value of the components or inventories. And that's, again, as I said, with zero cost, it's definitely wrong. But how much they put into it, or the electricity, how much should be considered the capitalized, how much should be considered the true production cost, that's subject to the cost accounting practices. And I think they should resolve this in the field between the companies and the auditors to be reasonable. I think as long as it's reasonable, it's fair.
Yeah, I think there's no question that in a single event company, you know, that only goes through this process once, these cash flows can't be replicated. They're not sustainable. On the other hand, one of the issues that was of concern to the people who raised this issue in the first place was they had a company that was avoiding taking impairment write-downs because it had credited so much testing against the asset. So they had artificially depressed depreciation on the other side. So it's one of these dynamics that it's hard to focus on a single situation.
Yeah, Wayne?
Yes, Sandy.
I couldn't hear some of what was being said, but I think the notion was that we shouldn't disclose these as revenues because they may not be sustainable. They may not sustainably reflect the earnings of the organization, which I understand. But I was just wanted to sort of echo what you were saying, netting them against the asset and indicating that there's a level of depreciation that is lower and is sustainable of another margin is equally bad, or maybe worse, right? Because if revenue isn't sustainable and we can explain why it's not sustainable, at least it's going through the income statement in a way in which it can be communicated to investors.
I think that was the point we were pursuing, Sandy. I think we're in agreement on that.
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't hear some of what was said. The microphone was on.
Okay, let's move on to transition then.
Based on our analysis in paragraph 16 of the agenda paper, we think that the benefits of retrospective application are outweighed by the costs. So consequently, we recommend prospective application of the proposed amendments to items of PPE made available for use from the beginning of the earliest comparative period when first applying the amendments. With that, we have question 2 in the paper on page 6 and ask whether you agree with our recommendations on transition.
May I ask a question before others come in? And I apologize that I did not focus carefully enough on the language. So prospective application to items of PP&E made available for use. Is that different than saying it's for credits?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Any testing credits that occur from the beginning of the first period forward?
Yeah.
And how is it different?
Any credits to the cost of the asset even before the beginning of the earliest period presented, if that relates to an asset which was declared as available for use during the earlier period, even those have to be adjusted. So it's okay. Just not for credits after the beginning of the earliest period presented.
So you do have a rollback. To a limited degree.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a rollback, but we've limited it.
John?
I agree with the recommendation. I think I agree with prospective, but I agree having the comparative, and I think that applying it to assets made available for use after the beginning of the comparative period is an appropriate approach.
Okay. Mary?
Sorry, something that has just struck me as we've been thinking about timing, and I think maybe it's a question to ask rather than a proposal to make, is to ask commentators whether there's any interaction with the effective date of IS 15 that should be considered. Because if people, sorry, thinking about this, let's say something is issued that if it has an effective date that's after the mandatory 2018 date for IFRS 15, and if an entity applying IFRS 15 did retrospective application, they may care more about getting their revenue on a consistent basis for all periods presented. But rather than working through some incredibly complex presentation, maybe just ask a question if people see any interactions with the effective date that should be considered. It would only matter if you were kind of prioritizing consistency of revenue presentation over PP&E from that date forward.
Andrew?
Just on the question of transition, I understand the reasons why the relief that's been suggested would be given. Having said that, in practice, you do sometimes come across assets where amounts have been credited against costs for a very long period of time. And so I wondered whether what you might say is a modified retrospective. And that would be rather than having the very high hurdle in IS 8, which is retrospective adjustment is impracticable, that retrospective application could be encouraged with this being applied to the extent it's possible without undue cost or effort. Now this is something where we do have some precedent because we have it in IFRS 9 when establishing the credit risk on initial recognition of financial assets held at transition date. And what that would then enable us to do would be to encourage people to go back if they're able to, and if they're really not able to because it really is costly, then they could do it just in the way that's been suggested. And that might then deal with some of the issues that the legacy issues brought forward, where the carrying value of some assets is very, very significantly depressed, and therefore we have the impairment and depreciation issue.
Do you really think, though, is this, remembering that I've been out of practice for an awful long time, that you wouldn't know what the credit was that you have to reverse?
It depends what sort of accounting records you've got. But I can think of assets in practice where I am told that there have been credits going against them for 5 years. So it's not always a short-term thing. And I think as well as that, there have been some mentions as we've gone along where the credits against assets have been so substantial that they practically take the asset down to a nil carrying value, yep. Which seems a somewhat inappropriate thing to have. So if you do have the information to back it all out, surely we should be encouraging it.
Bob?
I get that. I think that though some will, it's an impairment issue, right, to struggle with. Yeah, I'll have the credits. I'll know what revenues I deducted from the PP&E, what costs I added. But once I back those out, will I have then the sufficient information to do the impairment analysis that I would have had to for the last 30 years? And I don't think companies will have necessarily all that. Well, if I do this retrospectively and it's, you know, the equipment is 50-year equipment. Yeah. I'm exaggerating numbers, okay, but.
John, you have to leave shortly, so.
No, I mean, I like Andrew's suggestion, but I think those that have been crediting revenues to the asset for 5 years are not going to be motivated by strong encouragement to actually retrospectively apply the interpretation. So.
All right. Let's do this simple show of hands. Those who support the staff recommendation for a limited hybrid prospective retrospective. 12
in the room.
12 in the room. Sandy?
Yeah, I guess I would support that. But, you know, it occurs to me as I think it was Andrew was talking and someone said encouraging them. I don't think anybody would be encouraged to do it because they're going to get 2 credits to the income statement right now. So there's no real incentive to go back, right? They're going to get the credit for the testing they're currently doing going to the income statement. And they're going to get the deduction and depreciation from the past. I would just expect that if they do disclose it, that they would get some questions about what that ongoing depreciation looks like if it's a significant number without it from the analyst community, just FYI.
Okay. First-time adopters.
In respect of first-time adopters, based on our analysis in paragraph 18 of the paper, we recommend not providing additional transitional relief to first-time adopters beyond the deemed cost exemption in IFRS 1. So with that, we have question 3 and ask whether you agree with our recommendation of no exemption for first-time adopters.
Comments? Andrew?
I'm not sure why we wouldn't give the same relief to first-time adopters. And it's really looking at the reliefs now for S1. You have the fair values deemed cost election. You also have the limited election for oil and gas companies using full cost. And that's it. And so if I'm looking at someone who's just wanting to roll forward, I would have thought we would want to give the same kind of release to them, because if it's hard for existing preparers to go back, surely it's hard for first-time adopters to do it as well.
Trina?
Maybe I'll just explain a bit more thinking. So I agree, and I mean, there's a couple of reasons, I think, why we were suggesting not doing anything special here yet. One is definitely because we say, look, if it is very difficult, at least there is another option already there to first-time adopters that they can use, you know, sort of fair values, deemed cost. I think the other important factor, though, to say is if for whatever reason they decide that using, you know, that they prefer to kind of retrospectively apply IAS 16 to any of these items of PP&E, there is no other relief in IFRS 1 from any of the other requirements in IAS 16. So we think there would be incredibly little benefit to just saying in IFRS 1, you're going to get relief from this one sentence, one requirement in IAS 16, when you have to apply every other requirement in IAS 16 retrospectively, you know, in the case you don't deemed cost. So we just see the benefit that the downside of then providing it is that we create more complexity and you know, in all requirements where we think there's really very little of any benefit for a first-time adopter.
Andrew's expression shows grudging acceptance.
It's the end of the day.
Okay. Any objections to the staff recommendation? Okay, from here this goes now to the board, right?
Yeah.
And the full package that they will accept instantaneously. John?
I just have a comment on the wording of the proposed amendment in the appendix. I don't know, there's no questions on it. It's just a question. I mean, 21 is now a subset of 20, the new 20A, because 20A is talking about all revenues generated during the construction of the asset. So 21 is just a particular type of revenue, which is incidental revenue. It seems to me that the amendment could be made by just amending paragraph 21 to make it apply to all revenue generated while the asset is being made available for use. Because 21 is, the income that's, the incidental income that's from, or income from incidental operations in 21 is actually also covered by paragraph 20A, because 20A refers to all revenues generated. So just.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I'm just making it a one single paragraph.
What we can think about.
We'll think on that. Okay. This one's been a bit of a slog, but I'm glad to see we've gotten it to where we are.